is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Things aren't improving much in the economy. More economic numbers coming out this week. Weak retail sales, third month in a row. Industrial production down. And, of course, the G20 calling for governments to put their foot on the pedal and start spending money. Looks like things are weakening. We had a downturn coming from the IMF and the OECD on economic growth. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, John Kosar will be joining me. He's kind of looking at this rally, may continue a little further, but it's looking more like a bear market rally. John will be here to talk about that. We'll be talking about the gold market as well. Mark Chandler from Brown Brothers Harriman will be joining me later on in the program. Mark thinks even though the dollar has pulled back here in the last 6 weeks, given a respite to risk assets, as we've seen assets of all categories rise in the last 6 weeks, he thinks once again, given what we're seeing here in the U.S. and what we're seeing over there, the dollar once again will be resuming its historical secular bull market. All of that coming up along with Ryan Poplava on what moved the markets this week. All of that in hour number one.
And I'm John Loeffler. As you just mentioned, Jim, it seems that the economy is weakening, not just here, but globally. If we see corporate profits have peaked. And, you know, even despite all of these rather negative indicators, the Federal Reserve is still talking about, at least, of raising interest rates. You have to look at our economic recovery. It's been in fits and starts. Sometimes it goes back into negative territory. The new normal is really abnormal. So what's left to correct all of this as far as a game in town for the central banks? Quantitative easing, negative rates, and probably at some point in the very near future, we're going to see more helicopter drops if things slide back into a recession. We'll talk about that coming up in the big picture. And also, we'll give you some predictions and likely outcomes for the second half of 2016. I know we're not there yet, but we're getting there very rapidly, so we might as well look at the rest of the year. And first here on the program today, we are turning to Ryan Poplava to see what happened in the markets. Ryan, I'm sort of disappointed. It doesn't feel like it was a very eventful week. You know, nothing exciting we can come in here and talk about. No central bank meetings or minutes to look out. No jobs report. We don't have earnings here. What is driving the market?
We do have earnings.
We do have earnings. Okay. Well, all right. So let's
Not much. It's just getting started.
We'll talk about that and what's driving the markets. It really doesn't feel like we're driving anywhere in particular, you know?
Yeah, I know how that kind of feels. You know, we've been kind of oscillating a little bit on the S&P. You know, we were around 2050, 2050, plus or minus, but it was a good week overall, and especially actually overseas, John. There was a lot going on in Japanese shares and German shares, and we can get into that later. But there were some small headlines this week, but the market largely is looking for a new catalyst. Like you said, where it's might be, we got a lot of small headlines, but you know, real big, big macro moving headlines that can move the market for the next month, that didn't happen. But the catalysts that rallied the market were, you know, going back to what happened in the last few months, a flip in the recession think. You know, we've had some better durable goods orders, better PMI data from the market news. Looking at manufacturing in the U.S. has improved substantially. The Fed-induced sell-off in the dollar, you know, the Fed's gone on pause since, and they've completely flip-flopped their message from December. Then that also created a rally in commodities. And then there's oil in particular with the freeze discussion going on for the past couple of months. You know, there's been definitely a drumbeat there, and we'll finally hear a big clang or cymbal clash at the end of this weekend to get an idea of is there an agreement or, and whatnot. But, you know, I think many of the bulls have maybe felt a little bit of fatigue here. The ones that are in the market, not ready to get rid of their position. There has been, I felt like, some scrambling. We see that definitely in the financials with some of the earnings this week, a decent move there. But you know, we're 15%, John, off the bottom. And there really hasn't been a lot of opportunity to enter for anybody that kind of missed it with any kind of corrections here and there. There's been really zero pullback You know, we've been hovering, like I said, around 2050 plus or minus 25 points. In technical analysis, John, we do call that not a correction, but a time correction or a consolidation. So there has been that. There's been some concern 2 weeks ago, as I mentioned many times, that the market was overbought. Here we are, instead of correcting, you know, falling 10%, we've just been going sideways. There was a bit of profit taking in energy on Friday, though, when I'm looking at all the individual groups here, and that seems to be to make sense because we've got that big meeting in regarding Saudi Arabia's production freeze, Iran, Russia, OPEC coming together to formalize finally all the rumors that have been talked about, all the headlines since February about a production freeze, and then all the rumors that Saudi Arabia wouldn't do anything if Iran didn't. That was news last week. So we'll finally get final word here this weekend. So maybe some profit taking heading into that. You know, many oil investors wonder if we'll see a buy the rumor, sell the news scenario with the freeze. And you know, it's been widely discussed, John, these past couple of months, and oil's rallied 35% already. So you know, that very well could happen.
Well, you've been mentioning valuation concerns as well with a drop in S&P earnings. Now, does that still hold while we've started the first quarter earnings season this week?
It does, and I would say that the consensus around estimates is about as volatile as our market has been for the past 4 months. You know, we've seen earnings estimates, I don't know, if back to about this time last year when we started talking about forward earnings for 2016, the estimates were around 130 when we were originally at, like, I think 125. Last January, they were approaching 115 and we were talking recession. So, and then you deal with a PE ratio of maybe 16, 17, or 18. Those three price points give you a very wide range. So, you know, I don't think you can start talking about 2017 earnings right now. We barely know what's going on right now. But yes, the earnings season has started. You know, the banks got a lift this week based on better than feared results. They were powered by trading revenues and energy credit, which really hasn't worsened. You know, we haven't heard companies going bankrupt or having to restructure. We had Chesapeake restructure a couple months ago, and that was great news for that company. Citigroup's revenues, here's the interesting thing, fell 11.1%. Earnings per share fell 27% from a year ago. That doesn't sound that great, does it? But it's less than feared, so the stock initially rallied. And that's typically how our markets react when it comes to news. If news better, or if it's feared, less than feared, etc. Our report on the earnings, I think overall, John, once we get a little more, you know, further into this week, we've only had, this is just a start, very few companies announced in the first week. We really will get a big flux of announcements next week. So we can talk about it then. But so far right now, has the earnings season so far really had a big influence? Yes, I've seen estimates coming up, and also based on obviously economic news, which has improved as well. So that has helped the market. But I still think, you know, it's a bit of a stretch, you know, dealing with estimates for, you know, going out to next year and trying to price that into the market right now and looking at the 2200, I think is pretty far stretched, just as much as 1650 was back in February.
Well, there seem to be some decent moves this week overseas. I mean, specifically, I mean Japan and Germany and their equity markets. Now, what stirred up the shares to move as such this week?
Well, yeah, like I mentioned, they did move quite a bit. And some of that stemmed, well, let me backtrack here. The weakness in the dollar over the past few months has strengthened the yen. The rapid yen appreciation is obviously very undesirable for their economy. They export quite a bit and will likely result in government action. And we did hear from the financial minister this week, and we heard from the Bank of Japan's governor, Kuroda, who said on Wednesday, you know, he gave the very, very common answer we've heard many times before. Central bank here chiming in, willing to do more. And that's what he did, you know, willing to expand their bond buying program and slash rates further into negative territory. You know, January 29th, they surprised the markets with their cuts. And I think that huge surprise, that big move on top of what the ECB did. And then we heard from Draghi basically saying, well, you know, I think we did enough. I don't think we'll need to do much more from here. We've seen some strength, like I said, in the yen. And then weakness in the dollar as the Fed continued to pause and basically communicate their worry. So that huge gap that dollar strength we had over the past year and a half, that's been consolidating. And so that, when the yen weakens, and we talk about, we're conditioned, right, for central bank intervention. The bank says they're going to do more. We start propping up stocks. That's essentially what happened. And we've got the ECB announcement next week. They'll have a meeting. You know, I don't anticipate they'll do anything, but I think they came up in kind of unison with what's going on in Japan.
Yeah, and one isn't a central bank willing to do more. As a matter of fact, they tend to become the spots of last resort when governments start flopping around as far as trying to rescue situations. Now, what about China? Didn't they have some economic news that really helped stocks there this week?
Quite a bit. There was a lot of data points that came out, import prices. So yeah, China announced its first quarter GDP figures. They announced them at 6.7% growth compared to 6.8% last quarter, if I recall. So some of the items that showed up inside that report, industrial output is up, fixed asset investment, and retail sales all rose. Those were some of the news items we got this week, and better than expected. But you know, those results came by a surge in government lending and other stimulus measures, and that concerns many about China not being essentially committed to their economic shift towards a consumer-driven economy, and also concern about how much, you know, looking at their working capital, their reserves, which they've drawn down on there quite a bit, you know, how much more can they continue in supporting their economy through government stimulus and purchases, etc. You know, I think it may be that obviously, they want to continue their long-term change. The Chinese never do anything for short-term gain only. You know, I believe their long-term goals haven't changed. But it may be that, yes, on the short term, they've gone back to their old school ways of trying to help keep the economy. Obviously, they don't want to dip into a depression or recession. So they're going to do things to help and prop up their exports. They've done their currency adjustments. So, you know, many of the analysts, though, see this as really just a short-term reprieve, and they are a little bit concerned that the country will continue to rebalance and that they'll have to continue to go through those growing pains.
Well, the second half of the year is rushing towards us. Jim and I will be discussing that on the Big Picture today, but on a shorter term, anything we should focus on for next week?
Well, yes, in earnings, you know, it's going to be a much bigger week than this week as we get into week two. Week two and three are typically the largest. So when we're in this kind of a backdrop where there isn't a whole lot going on in the macro, yes, Bank of Japan's governor spoke this week and that kind of stirred up some things. But we're going to hear from the ECB next week, and I doubt they're going to do anything. They did their major move just, I believe, last month. And so they'll probably want to wait to see how the markets react to that, give it a little bit more time, as policy has a lag effect. Going forward, though, I think central bank focus will shift. I think as we saw that this week from U.S. to Japan, and given that import prices, the PPI number and the CPI number that came out this week kind of fell short below forecasts, that's giving our central bank a little bit more room to allow for a greater pause. So I don't think we have to worry too much about the April Fed rate hike. We'll mainly just be watching to see what Japan has to say for us next, which I believe is at the end of the month. Beyond that, the solid economic reports we got from China this week, that kind of really helps the metals and industrial industry groups and sectors. And so I think we want to continue to watch those areas. We've continued to see a nice rally in gold. I've seen some breakouts on some charts on bottoming patterns. And, you know, that's the kind of stuff that we want to see for a long-term change in gold and other materials. And of course, obviously, some of the PMI data figures that we just heard from China were positive and everywhere else. You know, that's very influential on global industrial type stocks. So that's one area I'm really continue to watch very closely. Obviously, very beginning of next week, we're going to have the results from the summit, the oil summit that's going to happen. So definitely going to be watching those oil stocks. And then obviously the correlation between oil and the market continues to be very strong. So we'll have to see how the market reacts to any kind of sell-off or profit-taking going on, or vice versa. If there's something that comes out of the meeting that the market wasn't anticipating and we see some growth, that could really lift the markets up. So those are the areas: earnings, oil, and then later on this month at the end, we'll be watching Japan.
And we'll look forward to having you talk about it next week. So once again, Ryan Poplava, thank you much. Good weekend.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense NewsHour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
John Hartley joins us on the show today, and he is the co-founder of Real-Time Macroeconomics, which is a data analytics project that provides real-time high-frequency macroeconomic indicators derived from aggregated online data. John was also a quant at Goldman Sachs Asset Management for a time, a statistical analyst at Dallas Cowboys doing a little bit of Moneyball sort of sabermetrics work with football, and also an economic research analyst at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago for about a year as well. John, before we jump into the message that you believe is coming from a lot of real-time online data that you track regarding the economy, inflation measures, and the like, tell us a little bit about your brief stint at the Dallas Cowboys as a statistical analyst. I find that fascinating because I did see the movie Moneyball, and I know that a lot of quantitative statistical analysis is being applied to sports. So how did you use that at the Dallas Cowboys team?
Well, thanks so much, Chris, for having me on. It's funny, I got that position with the Cowboys through one of my college professors, Stephen Levitt, the co-author of Freakonomics, and one of his former students went on to become the chief statistician for the Cowboys. And I grew up as a Dallas Cowboys fan, and so it was, for me, very much a dream come true to be able to help out in some way and to put some of the statistical tools that I've learned to work. It's really fascinating looking at the development of sports analytics within the NFL. It certainly follows that same tradition of Moneyball in baseball that you've seen spread to basketball and other sports.
Well, a little bit of good news this week for investors as stocks work their way up a little bit, but the market seems to be going sideways. Joining us from Asbury Research is John Kosar. John, let's begin with the S&P. We had a real nice run-up, in fact, in all risk assets since February. We saw oil prices go up, gold prices go up, emerging markets, even junk bonds. It was pretty hard to find something that wasn't going up. Are we in stall speed here, or does this have a ways to go here?
Well, it depends on what the time frame is. I'm apprehensive here because we're up against some formidable overhead resistance levels and a bunch of key indexes, not to mention that momentum has been stretched a little bit here since we made the lows in early February. So over the course of the next year, positive, but I think this is not a place to really try to chase this. In other words, if somebody has been sitting on the sidelines and saying, well, I'm going to wait and see what happens at these lows, and they're like, okay, now looks like it's safe to come back into the water, I don't like that idea. I came up on the trading floor, Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and board a trade. I saw a lot of guys get carried out. I saw a lot of guys lose their homes. So I tend to be cautious, careful, and having a good idea is only one half of the equation. The other half of the idea is putting the idea on at a good spot. And I just don't like chasing a big rally and then jumping it back into the pool when you're underneath these levels. For example, level in the S&P is 2082. We're trading 2081 as I'm speaking to you now. So I like the market. I think we're vulnerable to a little bit of a pullback. I would much rather buy a 5 to 6% pullback than load the boat here.
Here's one of the things that I'm concerned about with the problems that we've had with the rising dollar since summer of 2014. You see corporate earnings year over year, they're down, and I don't see anything that's going to make that number turn around anytime soon. We've had a lot of warnings coming in, and also we've had an economic slowdown in this first quarter, which is a good reason why the Fed has been holding off. You know, we're lucky if we get a 1% GDP print. So we've seen the economy slow since the fourth quarter. I just can't see anything that's going to revitalize profits unless investors, as you say, are willing to go in and pay more on a PE basis to own the same stocks.
I don't see anything here either. Price is king. Let's take four steps back and go back to where we were at the middle of last year. And I was talking about this. You and I were talking about this in spring and summer of last year. Tech tends to lead the entire market. So when I'm looking for opportunities or potholes that I could fall into, I'm always looking at stuff like technology and semiconductors first, because they're going to be the first part of the ship that turns, so to speak, either up or down. 5133 was the top of the tech bubble high in the comp, NASDAQ Composite Index. We tested it like six times between March and July of last year. And then we had the problems in China surface. Hang Seng fell apart. Shanghai fell apart. And we backed off of that 5133 level. The reason I'm mentioning it now is because now we're up against similarly formidable levels. I mean, they're not 15-year highs, but they're formidable levels here. So the market has to prove to me that there's enough investors out there that are willing to buy a fresh high. And until that happens, I don't know if you can make too much of this rally that we've had since February. I mean, it's been breathtaking. I mean, it's been a good rally. But until we start to break old levels, now we're at the top of a trading range that we've been in for the past year. And unless you're a trader, unless you're a hedge fund, we have some hedge fund clients that are trading in and out constantly. But unless you're that kind of a quick trader, it's never a good idea to buy underneath the old highs.
I know you follow not only just markets, but within the markets, different sectors. So, John, what does it tell you, even though we've had this return of risk assets here since February, where we've seen oil go back up over 40, we've got gold as high as 1280, but you also have stocks like Procter & Gamble and you have Coca-Cola, typically what we would refer to as defensive stocks, that are breaking out to new highs. Now, Coca-Cola is pulling back on the day you and I are doing this interview, but it's had a nice run from, let's say, last August lows, where it got down in the $35, $36 range, and today it's at over $46. So what does that tell you when you see stocks like Coke and Procter & Gamble and utilities doing well?
Obviously, it suggests that there's a defensive bent to the market. You know, that's how I would look at that. And going back to what you said, first part of your question is something that I've been really looking at, is if the stock market, if this little double bottom we made in January and February in some of the major indexes, including the S&P 500, if this is the springboard for a nice 2016, you know, more than just a nice couple of months or whatever, the threat of global deflation has to abate some. And what I see is a lot of these key economic barometers, some of the commodity markets, are all bumping up against the 200-day moving averages. Again, when I'm looking at 100 different charts, 100 different types of markets, you know, all over different kinds of asset classes, I try to keep it simple at first and see, okay, what's the trend? And I just have a little list here. A lot of the commodities that have had nice rallies are bumping up against their 200-day moving averages. We've got base metals, oil, equipment and services, coal, lumber, stuff of that nature. The CRB index, which is a broader index of a bunch of different commodities, including grains, industrials, foods, livestock, a whole list of things. So these rallies that we've had, all they've done is really taken these various prices back to the mean, you know, back to the trend. So if they can't continue to power up from here and get over those 200-day averages, you know, we're going to look back at this thing in a quarter or two and say, that was just a bear market rally, and now we're still in a deflationary situation with all these prices continuing these major downtrends that have been in effect in some cases for several years. So you got to be really careful of how enthusiastic you get here. You know, the poster child for this is probably, I'm going to the chart now, WTI crude. And we look at the spot closing price in WTI crude oil. Of course, we have Doha on Sunday. And I think a lot of the optimism for what may happen Sunday has already built into prices here over the past week or so. At least in my view, the level we need to watch for in spot crude is between $43.50 and $45 a barrel. We're underneath that now, and we haven't broken through it. Unless we can get through there and stay there, this looks like a bounce in a bear market to me, you know, just a rally in a bear market. So a little long-winded on this answer, but I think you've got to really watch these areas and make sure you're not getting too enthusiastic before we've actually broken trend.
And how much of this, John, parabolic rally that we've seen coming out of the February lows, how much of this was short covering?
It looks like a meaningful part of this was short covering. I think a lot of people thought that we were headed lower. You know, we actually took that January low out in February by just 10 points or 5 points in the S&P, and then we turned around and we were up 60 points within the next 3 or 4 days. So yes, I do think some of this is short covering. Yes, I think some of this is short covering in the oil market. I think there's a lot of people that were pushing oil down around the lows and they got caught short.
Let's move to the other side of the markets and take a look at treasuries. We started the year with the first rate hike by the Fed coming in December. The dot plot said a quarter of a point every quarter. That got reversed very quickly in the March meeting. We've got the April meeting coming up next week. Nobody expects him to say anything, but the consensus seems to be they're still going, that they're looking at maybe possibly 2 rate hikes. The futures market isn't buying that yet, but according to the Fed, maybe 1 in June and 1 in December. So let's take a look at interest rates. What are the charts telling you there?
Well, the charts are telling me completely different than what you just said. And a lot of that is attributable to where you're looking on the curve. You know, the Fed controls the short end, you know, the market controls the long end. And what I'm looking for and have been looking at for some time is I've got another 3-4% higher in long dated treasury prices. I'm looking at stuff like IEF, which is the 7-10 year iShares product, TLT, which is the 20 plus year product. And I'm also looking at the 30 year future traded at the Chicago Board of Trade. I've got another 3-4% higher in those assets. And if that happens, that would project down to maybe 160, 150 area in the yield of the 10 year. So when I look at asset prices, I try to look cross-asset, and we do a lot of intermarket correlation work here. And when I see something like that, you know, the next question is, what's going to get me there in terms of the economy? You know, what does the stock market have to do in order to get the yield of the 10 down to 1.5? And that fits in, as far as I'm concerned, with some kind of a correction in the second quarter that could potentially work its way into the third quarter. There are seasonality factors that are right in the middle of a seasonal peak here right now in the S&P 500. So there's a lot of stuff at play here. And if I am going to be right about rates, we're not going to charge up to new highs here on the first try in stocks. There's going to be a pullback of some kind.
It's absolutely amazing because you take a look at interest rates in Europe where they're negative. I mean, German bonds are 10 basis points. You take a look at Japan where we have negative rates. So even our rates look like junk bonds compared to what you're seeing overseas. So there's a lot of money, I think, that's coming into this market as a result. How long could we stay in this position? Because I don't see anything coming out of Europe or Japan that indicates that they're about to tighten or going in the reverse direction anytime soon.
That's a very good point, and I don't have the answer to that. I mean, I could tell you where I think things are headed over the next several months, you know, quarter or two. And after that, you know, the ground is shifting under our feet. I mean, it's really difficult to say beyond that. But I think for right now, if you ask me, what is the most compelling pattern data read that I see across all the assets we track, and we really follow the entire U.S. financial landscape, and our scope is pretty global as we're looking at correlations with markets overseas. The one that looks the strongest to me is that we're going lower in long-term rates. And if we are, I think that dovetails with maybe we haven't made a bottom in some of these economically sensitive commodity markets like copper, some of the other ones I mentioned, the CRB index a little more broadly. What I see based on looking across a lot of assets is this is a risky place to be adding risky assets here, buying stocks, and the potential is there for us to revisit those lows that we made or maybe even take those lows out, the ones that we made earlier this year. So bigger picture, I like the market. Near term, most of what I see suggests that for an investor, I would rather wait and let somebody else be the guinea pig and push this up to new highs than try to risk buying them here and looking for that 1 or 2%, you know, move higher to fresh highs, fresh all-time highs in some of the indexes. Because I think, you know, the downside of that is the 6 to 8% move lower. So the risk-reward characteristics just don't work for me here.
Let's talk about one final asset that's had a pretty good year. In fact, you're looking at gold stocks. They've probably been the stellar performers in 2016. What's your take on gold here?
When we talked around the end of the year, I told you that we track the commitments of traders data, which is tells you what various factions are doing in the marketplace according to futures open interest. And what we saw at the end of last year, actually we put out a piece on it December 22nd, was that hedgers in gold, which are either miners, people that are holding physical gold, or they're trying to hedge physical gold that is in the mine and they haven't gotten it out yet, they were unhedged. They were, for all practical purposes, they were unhedged. This hardly ever happens. They're always net short the futures market, try to lock in whatever the price is. So that told me at about 1040 per ounce, that's where the smart guys, the guys that are in this every day, saw that there was value in gold, and value to the point that they could lift their hedges. We've had a huge move since then. We caught a chunk of it, but we're out of the gold market right now. And the reason we are is because it moved up too far, too fast. And what I'm seeing lately is the asset flows in ETFs like GLD are starting to contract. They're starting to flatten out. They're starting to roll over. And what that means is the speculative interest in gold is actually starting to wane here. I really like gold. I also like steel. I like XME. We've been long XME, which is a metals and mining ETF. That's the strong place, by the way, just to take a step back. That's the area of the entire space of commodities that I like. I don't like them here. If you're not already long, I think we're going to get some kind of a pullback in the second quarter. That goes for gold, that goes for steel, that goes for base metals. Once we get those pullbacks, I want to get back in those markets because I think we've broken enough resistance levels on the top side to indicate that we could be going into some kind of a bull market here. But I wouldn't chase those assets here if you're not long them already, because we've had huge moves. And again, I talked about this earlier, the market direction right, and then getting the timing right as to where you go in. They're two equally important things. And maybe, you know, the second one is even more important, because what if you buy gold here and then we have a 10% pullback? We're still in a bull market. So now you have to get a 10% move higher just to get even. I would say keep your powder dry and look for a nice break into support. I mean, that's what we're doing. That's what we're telling clients. I think you're going to get a break here over the next quarter. And when you do, we're going to be watching asset flows. We're going to be watching hedger activity, and we'll find a new opportunity there.
So, John, given as we sum up here, we've had this explosive rally in risk assets all across the board, commodities such as gold, oil, even some of the other commodities such as copper, stocks have done well, junk bonds have done well, emerging markets have done well. So at this point, you would say take some chips off the table, sit back and wait for better buying opportunities. Would that pretty much sum it up?
But here's what I would say. The markets go up most of the time. So it's good to be long as much as you can. We actually have a model. It's correction protection model. It's been long since February 19th. When our model goes to neutral, that's when we're going to tell our clients, do whatever you do if you're playing defense. So I wouldn't take any chips off the table yet. I'm kind of waiting for the model to roll over. And there's three other things to look at also that above and beyond what we do in our model. Three things have to happen for us to have a correction. I'm talking near term now. I'm taking off my 1 to 2 quarter hat. Just kind of looking over the next couple of weeks. If we're going to have a peak, three things have to happen. You have to get widening in corporate bond spreads. You have to get a rise in volatility. I like to look at the VIX. People look at other measures. And I want to see contracting assets in ETFs that represent the major indexes, like the SPDR, like the Qs, IWM for the Russell 2000, you know, the diamonds for the Dow 30. Until those three things occur, we're going to stay steady to higher in the stock market. You know, we're not telling clients to get out of the market right now, but we're telling them to start to watch their stocks, start to watch their portfolio much closer, stay actually in closer contact with us here, because there's a chance, I don't know that it's a big chance, but there's a chance we just keep going higher and we blast through these resistance levels, and you don't want to have to chase this after it's already rallied 2%. So we're telling clients to tighten stops and watch for indications of investor fear, rising volatility, spreads are widening. You see some money coming out of these ETFs, and that's when you go into defensive mode, and we're not there yet.
Well, listen, John, as we close, if our listeners like to follow your work, tell them how they can do so, please.
We've just started over the past, actually part of this was as we started to talk to you, we've gotten a lot more interest from individual investors. So we have put together a package for them. There's four different reports that come out at various times throughout the month for a special price. If you contact us and let us know that you heard us on the show, we will send you some pricing information on that, and we'll send you a current copy of all of the reports that come inside of that little basic package we offer. We'd be happy to offer that to anyone who's interested in doing any investing over the next few months. We think it will hopefully steer you through what I think is going to be a pretty tough period between now and 4th of July. The contact point is asburyresearch.com, or you can send us an email at sales@asburyresearch.com. Mention the show and we'll get that out to you.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Dr. Jacob Olledort joins us today on the show to talk about the game theory of terrorism, how ISIS radicalizes other. And Jacob, you are a SOAR fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. You focus on Salafism and Islamist groups in the Middle East. And you're also an adjunct professor at the Elliott School of International Affairs at the George Washington University. And most of your work focuses on the intersection between Islamic law, theology, and modern politics. Let's start by talking about the game theory of terrorism, which I think is very fascinating. And you talk about what are referred to as the shelling points of radicalization. Would you mind telling our audience a little bit about the background from Thomas Schelling's work in game theory? And then let's move into how that applies to ISIS today.
Well, thank you so much, Chris, for having me on your show. It's a real great opportunity to be able to discuss my work with your listeners. I came across Thomas Schelling's work, and I found it very useful for understanding the unique way in which ISIS radicalizes its followers and appeals, really, to people as far as Brussels, as San Bernardino, to its cause, which is a bit unlike what you've seen with prior jihadist groups. So the work in which I draw is called The Strategy of Conflict. And that's a work that Thomas Schelling, a Nobel Prize winning economist, wrote in 1960 to explain really how bargaining works among different groups and individuals. And he had a number of experiments that he described in that book. One of which I found especially useful for understanding the ISIS phenomenon, was the Grand Central Information Booths experiment, in which he tasked a group of students to meet a stranger in New York. And that's all he gave them as a prompt. And what he found was that most students actually ended up meeting not only at Grand Central Station, but at the info booths at Grand Central, and they all arrived there at noon. And so this idea that a shelling point, really, or a focal point, is that groups and individuals can coordinate their expectations, their behavior, on the basis of what they assume other people will do. They'll do this without making plans ahead of time. So this is obviously 1960s, well before the days of text messaging and Twitter. These are groups who just arrive at the same conclusion just by assuming the same of their friends. And so we're seeing a lot of this phenomenon, as I see it, happening with ISIS. And the reason I don't take the view that it's only the ideology is because, as someone who studied Salafism for a good number of years, including my graduate training in it, most of the world's Salafis are actually not violent. And so there has to be something else in the equation that makes people flip and actually become violent and engaged with this violent form of ideology.
Well, for the last couple of months, the dollar has been in a downtrend. Of course, that happens to coincide with the rally in risk assets. Joining us on the program from Brown Brothers Harriman is Mark Chandler. Mark, let's talk about the dollar. We've been in sort of a downturn here since December. Is this just a temporary pullback in a long-term secular bull market for the dollar, or is something serious going on here?
Good question. I know a lot of people know that I've been bullish on the dollar, and like what's happened here in the first quarter, we've got negative interest rates by Europe, we've got negative interest rates in Japan, and yet we have a weaker dollar. But I think the driver has been the softening of the tone from the Federal Reserve. Remember in December when the Fed hiked rates, they said we'd probably hike rates four times this year. And the market never believed them, but more recently they said maybe only twice. And so I think that this adjustment has run through its course, and I think that what happened is that the dollar, I find the dollar tracks closely interest rate differentials. And with the Federal Reserve changing their tone, the interest rate differentials moved against the U.S. But the good news, I think, for people who believe the dollar is going up, like myself, is that those interest rate differentials have begun widening out again, partly because many economists, right now about three-quarters of them, according to the recent Dow Jones poll, think the Fed is going to raise rates in June, not in April. But if they're going to raise rates in June, that means that the April FOMC meeting later this month, that they're going to have to sound a little bit less dovish than they've been. And this is consistent with some of the official comments from many of the regional Federal Reserve presidents. So I do think the dollar's rally is going to resume. I think we're not far from its resuming. I think that it's entirely possible that the worst is already past.
So if we look at the dollar and assume that, at least according to the Fed, that they go twice this year, I heard maybe they go in June and maybe once in December, laying off before the presidential election. If we contrast that to what's going on in Europe, which looks like they're going to need more stimulus, and Japan is thinking the same way, and other central banks, it would seem if we take a look at your interest rate differentials, they certainly are widening. I take a look at the 10-year Treasury today, and it looks like a junk bond when compared to a 10-year German Bund.
Yeah, no, it's funny. It just strikes me, too, is that yesterday we had a disappointing retail sales data, and that the dollar strengthened. Today we had a slightly softer than expected CPI report, and U.S. Treasury yields are rising. In my mind, as an investor, this is important. When negative news and the market doesn't sell off, that's telling me that a lot of the bad news has been discounted, or that there's some other more positive fundamental development out there. And I think that's what's happening, is that we are slowly seeing people, I think, have gotten too bearish on the dollar. You see this in the futures where people have to commit whether they're commercials, that is, have an underlying business interest, whether they're non-commercials, meaning that they're speculators. And the speculators have now gone long the Swiss franc, the yen, the Canadian dollar, the Australian dollar. And I think that this is a bit exaggerated, and I think that the next big move has to be moving back into dollars. I think you're right, the ECB, you know, today we had a slightly better, that is higher than expected CPI report from the ECB. But it seems to me that given what they did last month, and what I mean by that is they did a lot of major moves last month that don't even begin to get implemented until June. So it seems unreasonable to expect the ECB to do anything again in the next several months. These programs have to be implemented, and then they have to be monitored to see the impact. At the same time, though, we've got the Japanese who, confounding many people, including myself, the Japanese yen has been among the strongest currencies, strengthened probably about 15% now since, say, December. And the Japanese are frustrated because they can't really intervene because that's too much of currency market manipulation and too much of beggar thy neighbor seeking competitive advantage from currency depreciation. So they're stuck using monetary or fiscal policy. The Bank of Japan meets later this month, and I think that ahead of that meeting, people will be cautious about extending long yen positions just in case the Bank of Japan surprises us.
So as we look at monetary policy in past cycles, Mark, you usually saw the Fed raising interest rates, the economy was overheating, higher rates of inflation. If you look at the PPI number this week, and then you take a look at weak economic growth, how would you explain the Fed moving forward raising rates? Is it in an attempt to really normalize monetary policy? In other words, let's reload the chamber because we don't like an empty chamber. It doesn't give us much ammunition if we go into another downturn. Do you see that as one of the main drivers behind this rate hike, or what is it?
No, I agree with you. I know that Lawrence Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, has sort of made a caricature out of this, saying that, oh, you guys want to raise rates till you can cut them. And I think that's not the right spirit. I think that the spirit is something like this. Policymakers want to maximize the options they have available. And right now, they don't have a lot of options. Should they need to, use it. When the U.S. economy was contracting, losing a couple hundred thousand jobs a month, it makes sense to have an emergency setting for policy. It's not like we're growing gangbusters, but I'd say the patient is not in intensive care anymore either. And I think the Federal Reserve is trying to be opportunistic, look for opportunities to raise interest rates to begin normalizing the process when the economic conditions allow for it. Because the other central banks are still in an easing mode, the Federal Reserve doesn't have to be particularly in a hurry to do so. So I think that helps explain the gradual aspect of things. But at the same time, the Federal Reserve has two objectives that are given to them by Congress. The first is full employment, and by many measures, you know, we're in the middle of earnings season. This will be the fourth quarter in a row that U.S. earnings have contracted. And yet businesses haven't really pulled back from hiring. The average job growth in the last 12 months is very close to what it was for the previous 12 months before the earnings began contracting. So businesses haven't pulled back, at least not yet. Employment stays strong. We're near full employment by many measures. And what about inflation? So until recently, inflation has been unusually low, but most recently, inflation has been creeping up. Why is inflation creeping up? Again, we're not talking about like what we pay as consumers, but the Federal Reserve wants to look at the core rate because over time, they find that the core rate is the true signal. And over time, the headline rate moves to the core rate, rather than the core rate moving to the headline rate. And so most recently, because of medical services, shelter, that's housing and rents, been creeping up, and there's been a slow increase in wages. The Federal Reserve is facing a bit higher of inflation. So in effect, why should the Fed raise interest rates? Partly to begin normalizing, partly because their objectives are very close to being met, and there's a lag time between you raise rates one day. It doesn't necessarily have an immediate market impact. It might take 3 or 6 months to run through the economy. And so once the toothpaste is out of the tube, it's too late to push it back in. And so the Federal Reserve argues by having slow increases now, it could deter the need to raise rates more aggressively later. So sort of slow and steady rather than waiting and having to be more aggressive.
Well, let's talk about another asset, which is gold. As the dollar weakened going back earlier in the year, we've seen a nice movement in gold prices here. What's your take on gold? Is it just a counter-dollar move, or actually participants seeing gold as an alternative asset class that makes a lot of sense right now?
The cost of owning gold, some people think it doesn't cost you anything to own gold. But so you put a couple of Krugerrands in your sock drawer, it's no big deal. But if you're going to put a serious amount of money in gold, you'd be buying gold bullion, not just paper claims on gold, and you need someplace to put it. And so frequently people would insure it and they would put it in a deposit like in a bank in a vault or something. These cost money to have. So when interest rates are low though, what's the alternative? And if you're in Germany, you're looking at minus 40 basis points on a 2-year note. So when countries adopted negative interest rates and given the low interest rates in general, the opportunity cost, how economists would put it, is a bit less in gold. I am a little bit concerned, though. I did anticipate the gold advance. Didn't anticipate going up quite as high as it did, which is 1285 back in the middle of March. I thought it would stop at around 1250. But I am concerned that gold right now is carving out a big topping pattern, that if we go back through 1200, I think we could see 1100 or so on gold again. What's going to happen, I think, is that the scare, and I think that the scare stays intact a little bit. Maybe we have to get through the British referendum. But I think in general, the panic that led to this big run-up in gold from, say, 1050 at the middle of December up to that 1285, that's a good 20% appreciation. I think that move is over, and I'd be looking for gold to work its way lower in the coming months.
So you think gold could be topping here. We know that the gold typically does not do well when the dollar is rising. Let me throw something out, though. Let's say that people are still worried about the Brexit and the dollar continues to rally because, let's say, the Fed does go in June. Is it possible we could see a dollar rally and a gold rally at the same time?
I think you can see that. I think you're right. It rarely happens, but I think you can see it. You'd probably need a set of circumstances. For example, say that the British vote to leave the EU at the end of June. And as some people fear, that leads not just to a political and economic crisis in the UK, but as the first country to leave the EU, maybe it triggers a wider crisis within the EU or maybe within the Eurozone, EMU. Under that condition, I can see where people would be frightened, unsure about the banks, like the UK banks, given that they're not going to be part of the EU. Under that condition, I can see where the dollar and gold can go up together. But I think you need a unique set of circumstances for that to happen.
Given that, let's talk about Brexit. In your opinion, what is the likelihood of that actually happening, number one? And number two, if it did happen, what would that mean for the euro and the dollar? I suspect the euro would weaken because there would be a lot of risk there as to the union's viability. And then that would also be another further strengthening of the dollar.
When we talk about like risk, people think how to think about risk in this kind of way. I think that from like the political scientists, we learn that risk is a function, a multiplication, if you will, of the odds of something happening, the probability, the capability of the threat, multiplied by the impact. And so in these event markets I look at, like a predicted, I don't think they advertise for it, but it's just one of these event markets where you can take wagers on political events. They say there's about a 40% chance it's going to take place. Eurasia, which is a political consultancy group, they recently raised the odds of Brexit from 30% to 40%. I've been thinking since early February that the risks of Brexit are going up. Partly, I see several things that have like sort of pushing me more and more into thinking that Brexit is a very serious risk. The government is advocating staying in. One of the leading advocates of it, basically the Treasury Minister, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and he had a horrible budget that was really, within 48 hours of him releasing the budget, people were already lampooning it. Then, a couple weeks ago when the Panamanian papers were leaked, it turned out that the Prime Minister's father and him himself was a partial beneficiary, and he didn't handle the situation very well. Then, of course, was the terrorist attack in Brussels. And then there's the ongoing challenge of immigration in the EU. The bottom line is it's a very emotional appeal, and the people who want to leave the UK seem to be increasing their strength. The people who want to stay in, their campaign is primarily one on fear. That is to say, if we don't stay in, bad things are going to happen to us. As opposed to saying, here is why the Tory party back in the early 70s brought the UK into the EU in the first place. Here are the positive things that EU does. In this day and age where I think nationalism is on the rise, when all the smart elites say one thing, it incentivizes people to do the opposite. All work against the UK. What we've been trying to suggest to our clients is they reduce their sterling exposure either directly by selling the sterling asset or hedging themselves using the options market. I do think that if the UK were to leave, it would be a political crisis in the UK. I'm not so convinced that it's going to trigger a big systemic crisis in Europe, but the risk is there. It would be the first country to leave the EU, and other countries might feel emboldened by it. For example, recently the Dutch had a referendum about a trade association agreement with Ukraine. They rejected it, and the party that seemed to be on the rise was another nationalistic anti-immigration party.
As you look at the world today, we've got slowing growth rates, especially in Europe, Japan, elsewhere in the world. Mark, the IMF just lowered once again its international growth rates for GDP. You've got possible rising interest rates in the U.S. because the Fed, even though it's been dovish, hasn't backed away from its intent to raise interest rates. You also have here in the U.S., we've seen four quarters now where earnings have peaked. So you've got declining corporate profits. Where do you put money to work in this kind of environment? Doesn't seem like there's a lot of choices. If you're in Europe, you've got negative rates. You've got negative rates in Japan. I suppose if you're in treasuries here, I guess 1.7 or 1.8 treasury looks better than, let's say, 10 basis points on a bond.
No, you're right. I think this is a hard thing because back in January when the stock market was selling off, I think we chatted and I was thinking that the stock market was going to have a W-shaped bottom. And that's what we got. It's like a double bottom back in middle of January, middle of February. And once we got above about 1950 in the S&P, that broke the neckline of that double bottom of that W pattern, and I thought it projected up to 2100. We're getting very close. I mean, even today we made a new high, 2085. It scares me that how high the stock market is. I think a lot of value is gone already, back at the old record highs. And like you say, earnings growth is still very poor. My own personal account, I've moved a bit more into cash. And instead of looking at the ETF type index type plays that I usually can do as a macro person, I begin a little bit more particular about individual stocks that I think have some scope. For example, I've been in the oil sector. I've had it for over a year. I'm not smart enough to pick a bottom to oil. So what I wanted was a good oil company among the best in the breed that continued to invest during the drop in oil prices to plan for the future. And that was not going to go away because of bad debt. And so I looked at Statoil, which is Norway has a state-owned company that is their oil company. When I bought it about a year ago, it was paying about a 5.5% dividend. The stock is flat, but it's come off well off its lows, of course, with oil prices, and it pays a good dividend. For me, it was like a way to express my view that oil prices weren't going to go down to $15 or $10 a barrel like some of the doom and gloom camp thought, but that I wasn't smart to pick a bottom, so I needed something to pay me while I waited.
Given this fact, maybe specific dividend-paying stocks, anything you like in the currency world outside the dollar? I know you're still bullish on the dollar. Any other currencies look good to you?
You know, I think that there's some interesting plays in some of the high-yielding emerging markets. Brazil's going to have a vote this weekend about impeaching Dilma. A very attractive yield for U.S. dollar-based investors as well as for foreign-based investors. I think that the Japanese stocks have been among the more miserable stock performers this year. The Japanese stock market as a whole, as the yen has gotten stronger. If I'm right that the dollar is bottoming against the yen, Japanese stocks might look attractive again. I mean, I would personally be thinking of it on a hedged basis, but there's a lot of different vehicles to either on a hedged basis, currency hedged basis, or on an unhedged basis. So I like the Japanese stocks right now. Europe still scares me. I think that they're still headed for a bit of a political crisis, whether it's June or July. What's interesting about the June date is the referendum, not only in the UK, but Spain might have elections shortly around there too. So I think Europe is headed for a crisis, and so that's what scares me about European markets. Chinese stock market I don't think is transparent enough for my small amounts of money. I'd rather have something I can see and know and greater deal of trust for. So I'm thinking still that world, it looks very dangerous, and we'll have to see what happens this weekend with the Doha talks, if they can really sustain the move higher in oil prices. I doubt that as well.
All right, Mark. Well, listen, as we close, if our listeners like to follow your work, how could they do so?
Thanks a lot. I have a blog called Mark to Market. That's MARCTOMarket.com. I'm also on Twitter, where my handle is Mark Making Sense. And I have a book that came out back in 2009 that had basically anticipated this big dollar rally called Making Sense of the Dollar. I'm working on another book right now that should be out before the end of the year.
All right. Well, be sure to contact me when that comes out. Would love to have you on the show to talk about it. Mark, listen, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the show. Have yourself a great weekend.
Thanks. Good luck to everybody.
We keep getting themes that the economy may be weakening. Corporate profits have peaked, and despite all of these indicators, the Federal Reserve is still talking about raising interest rates, still trying to build itself some wiggle room. But what happens if we turn downward into a recession before they can get enough clearance? Perhaps the only game in town will be still quantitative easing, negative rates, and helicopter drops. Some banks are talking about it, like the Bank of Japan. We'll talk about that coming up in the big picture, as well as most likely outcomes for the second half of 2016. I know we're not there yet, but we're getting there. So let's look at what second half 2016 is going to look like. All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.